You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Liz Old.
And I'm Josh Weber. Tonight, Dave Fedick speaks with Patrick Cabello Hansel, the author of Quitting Time, a new collection of poetry. Hansel is a widely published poet and has authored a novella that was serialized in 33 issues of the Alley News. He has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and received awards from the Loft Literary Center and the Minnesota State Arts Board. A retired Lutheran pastor, Hansel lives in Minneapolis.
And I'm Annie Harview. In the second part of the show, Liz Olds will talk with Jim Walsh, author of Fear and Loving in South Minneapolis, a veteran Twin Cities journalist and raconteur summons the life of the Twin Cities after reporting and recording its stories for more than 30 years. Cannot wait to talk to Jim. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio. Dave, take it away.
Thank you, and hello, Patrick. Is it Patrick?
Hello. Patrick, it is.
Welcome to Right On Radio. It's a pleasure to have you here. We have quite the show. I'm excited about the Jim Walsh interview myself, but let's start out with some really great poetry. Before we hear from a reading from Quitting Time, your collection of poetry, Patrick, let's talk about your connection to poetry, how it became a part of your life. And first of all, by the way, I'm going to give you a big compliment on that COVID hair of yours. I mean, that's really impressive.
Okay. Thank you. My wife is my barber, and she's sitting right next to me, so she should take credit for that.
Well, very good. I'm sorry the folks at home can't see it. I cut mine a couple months ago. At any rate, sorry about that. Tell us how you got introduced to poetry and when it became a part of your life.
I always was interested in telling stories, and I made up stories even as a young kid. I think I had poetry kind of beaten out of me in high school. They just taught it in a way that was it was so boring and did no connection to life. And then in college, I started reading more. And then, to be honest, I went through a lot of changes between my junior and senior year in college. And a lot of things happened that were hard. And I was in a poetry class, and it just seemed like that's the form to start to write about that. And then I also started to just read all kinds of different folks. So that's what got me going.
Yeah. Awesome. That's great. Thank you for that, Patrick. And how about kicking us off with a reading now and set us up?
Okay, the book is called Quitting Time, and it's about my father, Walter Hansel. He was born in 1912 in far northeastern North Dakota to immigrants that were from Germany and what is now Ukraine. So he grew up speaking only German. And so this poem is called Mother Tongue. I'm just going to read part of it. It's kind of a long poem, but it's about when he went to kindergarten for the first time. He was the oldest of seven children from a poor farm family. It's on page 10, if you're looking. So Mother Tongue. 1917 was a bad year to go to kindergarten in Langdon, North Dakota, speaking only German. Our father told us the teacher threatened with the back of the hand each ya or nine that slipped from little lips. Imagine that five-year-old, uncertain in his farm pants and the best shoes of the family, playing in the dirt outside the schoolhouse, carving the alphabet with a stick, making his sagas out of dust. What do you say when you are 5 years old and the son of grandson of the enemy? Guten Morgen is what his bright blue eyes are shining, but his lips tremble at the fear of the Lord incarnate in an American Fraulein whose brother is being shot at over the ocean and over dirt that holds no man's claim. This child has no ways to distinguish yes from guess or past from pest. He is an unwelcome guest in the land and country of his birth. Watch him as history's slow march tramps the ground, how he tries to wrap his synapses and the sinews of his mouth around the new tongue and the dirt it was born out of. Watch his tongue, watch his hand.
Thank you, that's Patrick Hansel reading from Quitting Time, a new collection of poetry. Patrick, I have to begin by saying how much personally I connected with your poems. I was moved by them and very much taken by them. I come from Germans from Russia, living the hard life in the North Dakota prairie. My mother lived in a sod house till she was 10. I could go on and on. A lot of us have these kinds of stories.
Oh, yeah.
And your poetry really spoke to me. I want to begin with what struck me, among many things, is the novel-like feeling of this collection. Each poem felt like a chapter in a story. And I have to say, I haven't encountered something like that in quite some time, at least among contemporary poets. I really loved that. I felt like I was reading a novel. I wanted to turn the page for the next chapter, that kind of experience. Mm-hmm. So kudos to you. I mean, you've really created something narratively compelling. Was this your intent?
Well, when I started off, I was just trying to write poems about my father. And to be honest, I couldn't really do that for a while after he died. You know, it just took a while. And then I started also researching things in his life historically. Like, he had a really challenging life with the Depression. The Klan was actually in North Dakota and didn't have a lot of African Americans or Jews, so they burned crosses in front of Catholic homes, and they burned one near his home. Then the Depression and so on. I mean, it was a really rough kind of time. And I started imagining, well, what is it like for him through that? I didn't start out with a novel idea, but then it just became that as I learned little bits of history.
Yeah.
And then went from there.
Well, you describe life on the farm as if you were right there at that time. It's really amazing. So you grew up on a farm, is that right?
No, I grew up in Austin, Minnesota. My dad was a barber, but I worked on farms as a kid.
Okay,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. So, and he talked about the farm, and we went to visit. His brother still lived on the family farm there. So, and actually, yeah, we were there just a few years ago. So.
Yeah, you really capture that beautifully. You capture war beautifully too. And I don't know if you've experienced it. Certainly didn't experience the world wars as you described them. But ladies and gentlemen out there in Radio Land, this is poetry about war, about love, about farm life, about all kinds of things, father-son relationships. And now I lost my train of thought. Oh, the KKK thing. Yeah, there it was. You mentioned it, and I was going to raise it later, but since you did mention it, that's news to me. I knew there was the KKK, the Klan, in the upper Midwest. I had not heard stories about it on the windswept prairies of the Dakotas. Can you tell us a little bit more about that phenomenon?
Yeah, and there's not a lot written about it, but what I understand from researching just the KKK in that period of time, this would be in the 1910s, is that the KKK was against immigrants, and particularly against immigrants that were Catholic and were from darker skinned. And also, there, a lot of the Catholics were known as drinkers. They opposed prohibition, which was moving towards being enacted during that time period. And so I think those two things got conflated. My father, when he was a young boy, actually drove a farm cart with horses with his father and I think his uncle, bringing, you know, liquor from a still that someone else had. So he was well aware of what was going on there. And I don't know if that was part of it or if it was just, you know, the KKK always looked for the other, you know, let's find someone to blame on and hate.
Right.
And so, you know, with no blacks or Jews there, they went after the immigrants.
Yeah. I want to come back to your relationship with your father. It's a very poignant one. And you say you could not begin writing these poems until he had died and some time had passed. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
What was your, we get a sense for what the relationship with your father was like, but tell us a little bit about that.
So, you know, we were close when I was younger. I was a second son. So, And I had a traumatic brain injury when I was 10 weeks old. I fell off a table when my dad left me. He was changing my diaper. And I think he felt really guilty about that, to say the least.
Can I stop you there, Patrick? With apologies, can I stop you there? That was
a
striking moment in the poems, in the selection of poems. I had to read it twice And then to come to realize it was you was another revelation. A very powerful moment in the story, I must say.
Yeah. Yeah. And I imagine him, you know, as a young father, and a barber working, we didn't make a whole lot of money to, he left me for just a few seconds because my older brother, who was two, was fussing at his nap, I guess. And I rolled off the table, which 10-week-olds shouldn't be able to do, but somehow it happened. Yeah. And had surgery three times at the Mayo Clinic and survived. And so, I mean, I think that kind of told my place in the family. But then by the time I got to be a teenager, we were butting heads like nobody's business. I mean, it was really not a good relationship. Yeah.
Was that about your father?
I mean, he was a barber and I had wanted to grow a ponytail.
Yeah.
I think it was, you know, so this is late 60s, early 70s. So it's about the war. It's about civil rights. It's about, you know, smoking marijuana. It's about all that stuff.
Right.
But also I think my father was going through some transition there too.
Yeah. There's a line I thought of when you were speaking from the poem Evacuating on page 34. Hate is the first sin obligated by fear. I love that line, among other lines, and I'll probably raise some more for our listeners. But tell us what you mean by hate is the first sin obligated by fear.
Well, that was written in the context. He was already in the Army when the war, when the U.S. got in the war. He was stationed in the far out Aleutian Islands, which was actually closer to Japan than Hawaii was. Mm-hmm. And so, and they had to evacuate. And one thing I really appreciated about my father was that he never talked about the enemy in derogative terms. You know, he didn't say, like a lot of people I grew up with talked about dirty Japs and the Krauts and all that. He would never allow that kind of talk and talk about them, even though I'm sure he had seen people killed and he had shot down at least one plane because he was an anti-aircraft gunner. But he didn't, you know, that fear that it, to me, it connected his being evacuated there with the whole fear in the country then that locked up all the people of Japanese American descent on the West Coast, that, you know, when you're afraid, and that's true today too, when you're afraid, you find somebody to hate. That's a way to take away that fear and give you a false sense of power. It really doesn't help, but that's how it works too often, I think.
Yeah. And you write very poignantly, I guess I would say, in terms of the war, to have first and second generation immigrant Germans going over to Germany to, in effect, fight against, you know, likely family members or some sort of second or third cousins. Then, as you know, as many Germans here in America, especially in the First World War, I believe, you can correct me on this, were, I guess I'll just use the term, persecuted in some way, shape, or form. Many were jailed because they were German, much like the Japanese, worse than the Japanese in World War II, and they were incarcerated in effect. But to what degree was that a part of your family lore, that whole otherness of being German in the early generations?
You know, and I didn't really get that. Like many men in his generation, he didn't talk about the war a lot. You know, we heard bits and pieces. As he got older, I think he particularly as his sons then faced Vietnam, he got a different take on that. But I grew up kind of being ashamed of that side of my family. My mother's almost pure Irish, and that was lifted up more than the German. But it was interesting because he was in the occupation in Germany. And I never heard him speak German, but my older brother married a woman whose mother was German. And when they came to visit, he started speaking. That's really interesting.
Oh, wow. Say, Patrick, you're cutting out on us a
little
bit.
Can you hear me?
You're cutting out on us a little bit. I wonder if you could turn off your video, as much as I like looking at that marvelous hair. Turn off your video. Maybe we'll put all the power into the audio. I don't know. No idea what I'm talking about, but it might work.
No, I know that helps sometimes, so.
Okay. We're talking about old times and telling stories about the past. There's another line in the poem On the Streetcar, where you write, "Or was it all a romantic dream I've inherited of you?" This is when you're talking about memories or stories. And it got me thinking about memory and writing about things we may have experienced or may have heard about. As a poet, Patrick, how important is it for you to get these stories right? Or is it more important to get these stories told in a way that, you know, makes a point, establishes a mood, and that sort of thing?
Well, I'm not the only one who does this, but I would distinguish between truth with a small T and truth with a big T. I don't know the details of what it was like for him on that streetcar. I know that coming back from the war, having been in small towns, he ended up at Barber College in Minneapolis, which was down by Hennepin and Washington. Well, at that point in the city's history, all the liquor was concentrated there, all the flop houses, all, and he didn't like that. And he couldn't wait to get out of that. So he would talk about that, not detail well, but I just put him on the streetcar and I said, okay, what would he see? What would he feel? So I'm making that up, but I think I'm doing it in the sense of what really happened.
Yeah. I like that small T, capital T truth idea. You're probably right. That holds true for many poets. Patrick, I'm going to remind our listeners who we are speaking with, and then I'll ask you to give us another reading when we come out of that, okay? We are talking to Patrick Cabello Hansel and about his collection of poetry, Quitting Time, and you are listening to Write on Radio on the coolest radio station in town, I'm sure, KFAI.
Yeah, amen. And become a member if you're not.
Thank you. That's where I was going to go, Patrick. Oh, hey, we're good friends now. Become a member if you're not. That's right. Thanks, Patrick. So give us another reading, please, and set us up what you're going to read.
So this is the section from the war, and it's called Falling. And if you remember, he was threatened to be hit as a five-year-old if he spoke German.
Yeah.
And the situation here is he's the staff sergeant of a unit, an anti-aircraft unit, and this is an experience that he related just to me and not to my other brothers. Falling. A man hung from his parachute like a seed softly whirligigging down, shouting, "Don't shoot, I surrender," in the tongue of the enemy, your first tongue. He had no way to reach his weapon, but the men under you did. And in a minute, though your voice was raised and your rank commanded obedience, it was the county fair in Shreveport, in Pembina, in New Ulm, and New Prague. Step right up, everyone wins a prize, the lights flashing, the girls all giggles and bullets, and a ribbon for the man who hits the nose. Then silence, the head of the boy on his chest, his body limp in its harness, gravity doing its work. The son of German cousins, perhaps the grandson of your grandfather's friend, spoiled blood over his uniform. Father, why did you tell me this story and not my brother's? Your memories are like your hands, big, calloused, open. His boots, newly shined, pulled him down to the earth he finally met as a shroud, a nothing, a home. Your men did not speak. They held their rifles across their chests as if bearing sick children.
Thank you for that, Patrick. Where did that poem come from for you? Did that come from a story, or did you just want to give us a sense for the war itself?
Well, I remember once my dad talking, and he almost broke down. He wasn't a man who did that a lot when I was growing up, but he talked about how sometimes in war you do things you don't want to do. And then he told me the story and how, even though he was a sergeant, he felt powerless because his men disobeyed his orders not to shoot and shot this guy that was surrendering, because only he understood that he was surrendering because the guy was speaking in German. And then at the same time, I started talking with my brother, who heard another story about how they, when they're in the Aleutians, they had to go. That was the only part of the U.S. that was captured during the war by Japan, a couple of the Far Islands. They had to go stab the bodies of the Japanese soldiers on the beach because living soldiers would hide among the dead. And so I began to think, well, why? Those had to have been terrible memories for him. Why did he? And I understand why he wouldn't share that, you know. And then the irony of he's threatened to be hit when he's 5 years old for speaking German, and then his German comes in handy for his country when he goes to war.
Yeah. Wow. Beautiful lines in that poem. A man hung from his parachute like a seed softly whirly geeking down. I've made a lot of notes of lines that I've loved in this book. A bird stolen from sleep, crickets hawk the air, the words that arise from the thawing ground. Patrick, do those, for some poets, these sort of phrases and ideas just sort of come to them? Does that happen for you, or do you find yourself laboring over trying to find the right word for the right place?
I think it's a little of both. Some of those natural words, I spent a lot of time outdoors, even though I've lived in the city much of my life. Mm-hmm. Some of those just kind of come out. And on the best poems in this book, I think it's not like I was in a trance, but I was in a place where I was there and right. creating a there. And it just can't, but then every single one of them is, you know, revised and rewritten, you know, sometimes dozens of times.
Right.
And also with the help of other poets. So.
Oh, so you, how do you work, Patrick? Do you get up every day and get the notebook out? Do you work as a group with other poets? I haven't heard of that yet in terms of poetry.
Yeah, I don't work writing poems, but we send poems to each other and then give feedback on them. So I'm in a group that meets by Zoom once a month, and then two other poets where we just send them by email and then get back to each other.
Well, that's cool. You know, before we run out of time, and believe it or not, it's going to happen really quickly. If we can segue or move away from talking about this poetry collection and a little bit about your serialized novella. How did that happen? I'm really curious about that.
Yeah, well, the Alley News is the monthly paper for the Phillips neighborhood. And my wife and I served as pastors there for 15 years, and I wanted to write something set in the neighborhood. And it's about two young immigrants, Angel and Luz, who face challenges. And I integrated some of the happenings, like there was a big immigration raid in the neighborhood, and they get caught up in that and escape. But then it also, during those months that it was serialized, I would ask people that read the paper, where do you want them to go? Like, what places in the neighborhood? So they went to the school, they went to the Heart of the Beast, they went to, Maria's Cafe, they went to the park and so forth. And then the story just kind of evolved out of that.
Great. Say, I got a 2-minute warning, 1 minute and
okay.
Tell us how you and your father left each other in terms of your relationship. That's a big, big question to end things.
Yeah. Well, thank God. After I went to college, I got smarter, not because of college, but I realized how angry I was. And I think he did too. And we reconciled early on. And so we had a very close relationship for about 22 years.
Well, that's wonderful.
Spent a lot of time talking. Yeah. I miss every election because I lived out in the East Coast for 20 some years. We'd call each other and celebrate or moan the elections. And I miss doing that with him.
That's great. Very quickly, what are you working on next?
I'm working on a novel and my third book of poetry, which is, I don't have a title for yet, but it has a lot to do, again, my first book had a lot to do with immigration. It has a lot to do with immigration and the land and people's struggles.
Awesome. Well, Patrick, let us know about both of those books when they're ready to go. We've been talking with Patrick Cabello Hansel about his poetry collection, Quitting Time. Patrick, thank you very kindly. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you. You too.
And now this.
Jim, can you hear me?
I can, Liz. Is that you?
Yes, that's me. Can you see me? I'm somewhere on this.
I can.
Great.
Hello.
We're talking to Jim Walsh, author of Fear and Loving in South Minneapolis. Why don't you start with the reading? And then I know you shared with me on the phone that you have something special you'd like to talk about. So why don't you just go right into that, and whatever time we have left, we'll ask some questions. Does that work for you?
Absolutely. I just, you know, my dad died on Friday, and, you know, given that Right On Radio is just, you know, the one stop for all things groovy literary, you know, he loved books, and he loved talking about books, and our house was just filled with books growing up, and, you know, his house was filled with books. He loved writers. And he and my mom are, you know, the two biggest book lovers I've ever known. And they both have had, you know, they read, you know, spirituality, fiction, philosophy. And yeah, I'm here. I'm you know, I'm thrilled to be on Right On Radio because, you know, I catch it all the time still over these years. And it's such a necessary thing, and I always find it really calming in some way to hear writers talking about writing and reading their work. So grateful to be here, and I wanted to pay homage to my dad in my new book. It's a collection, Fear and Loving in South Minneapolis. This is called Thanks for the Scourge, Dad. And I wrote this in 2008, and it originally was published as my column in the Southwest Journal. My brothers and sisters and I grew up in a big house on 51st and Colfax when the neighborhood was crawling with baby-boomed Catholic families. My dad had his own upstairs office that was filled with stacks and shelves of books, a tiny TV, and a door that was always wide open. All six of his kids walked through that door countless times, collapsing on his couch to find guidance, warmth, wisdom, laughs, and a few bucks off the bat. My dad turns 80 in May. He's had some health problems in the past few years, but he's still up and running and around and kicking. He grew up in this neighborhood behind the Boulevard Theater, and a block from Annunciation Church in grade school. And everywhere I go these days, I see signposts from his and our youth. It seems like we're getting ready to say goodbye, but I'm not quite ready for that. So today I want to talk about a lesson my father passed on to me, maybe by mistake, maybe the most important one. When I was 8 or 9, my daughter's age, my dad would come into the bedroom I shared with my brother and lie down on my bed, face down on the pillow, exhausted after a hard day's work as an employment counselor. Outside the window, the stars winked and promised UFO sightings, a potentiality that enthralls us both to this day. As soon as he got comfortable, my dad, still in his work shirt and tie, would gently demand, "Give me a scourge." For most of the world, the most common term is back scratch. But somewhere along the line, Dad morphed it into scourge. When he asked, we'd set to it, always more pleasure than chore, under or over the shirt, and never longer than 5 or 10 minutes. As we grew up, the older kids would pay the younger kids a quarter for a scourge as we played Boggle or Scrabble or watched sitcoms, sports, the news, or Leo Biscaglia, the hugging guru of the day, who said, "Too often we underestimate the power of a touch, a smile, a kind word, a listening ear, an honest compliment, or the smallest act of caring, all of which have the potential to turn a life around." Diane Ackerman, in her amazing A Natural History of the Senses, said that, quote, "Touch might be as essential as sunlight, which is likely not news to the thousands of sad sacks around this burg." SAD sacks, that is. To be sure, there are all sorts of studies out there about how touch helps and heals. It connects us to another life form, gets us in touch with each other and our own inner pack dog, and soothes the savage beast. It's why we go to massage therapists, have pets, and crave the warmth of another body. Personally, I'm convinced that giving each other back scratches all those years is what has kept my family close over the years, passing it on as we have to spouses, lovers, and other animals as we go. Beyond the touch part, the scourge would always lead to a story or a talk. Dad would tell me about his work. I would tell him what I did at school. He would make up a story. I would make up a story. It's part of what set me on a path of seeking and storytelling, which brought me to two bookstores last Sunday, doing what my dad has spent his life doing, browsing. I picked up five new books, including Anais Nin's Henry and June, Cormac McCarthy's The Road, Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and Rabbi Irwin Kula's Yearnings, Embracing the Sacred Messiness of Life, which states early on, Jewish wisdom teaches that our yearnings generate life. Desire animates. As the prophet Amos says, seek me and live. Jewish wisdom urges us to go for it, to seek answers to our deepest questions, to search for spiritual and personal fulfillment while knowing we will never finally get there. Oh, but the discoveries we'll make along the way. We are meant to live, to search with intention. When we can uncover our deepest longings for intimacy, pleasure, creativity, and self-understanding, life yields illumination and happiness. Far from being a burden, our desires themselves become a path to blessing. I can draw a straight line from bolts of wisdom like that to my boyhood bedroom. And as I make my way now as a man and father, part of my studies will always be linked to the action of my hand gliding over my father's back, his oil and sweat pooling under my fingernails, and knowing even then how special it was.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for sharing about your dad and your authentic self with us. It's always nice.
And, thank you.
And we here at KFAI send out our condolences and our best energy to you in your time of grief.
Thanks very much.
You bet. You bet. And thanks for coming. Thanks for coming tonight.
Yes. Happy to be here. We've been Irish waking it all week, so it's we're happy.
Well, you know,
happy to be here, and yeah, good to be here.
Yeah, yeah. Why don't you now we'll get to the book here, which that essay was from the book Fear and Loving in South Minneapolis. Why don't you tell us some about this, the overall essayness of it?
Yeah, it's a collection. It's my second collection for the University of Minnesota Press. I put one out a few years ago called Bar Yarns and Manic Depressive Mixtapes, which is mostly all music. And then this year came around and I had a bunch of other very much life essays, like the one we just heard, and interviews and journalism that I felt would be good in a collection too. And luckily, U of M Press agreed, and they live. Fear and Loving in South Minneapolis it spans like 30 years. And, you know, it captures a lot of stuff that is gone now. I mean, when I think about it, I keep saying, you know, it's a history book in some way, because two of the places that I wrote regularly for the Southwest Journal and City Pages are gone. You know, the shrinking of news holes in community newspapers like that and news deserts is a real problem. And it's interesting for me to look at, you know, 30 years of my work where I had, you know, editors who encouraged me to write personally and trusted my voice. And that's the truth of alternative journalism and independent journalism. And yeah, I'm very lucky to have compiled a lot of my stuff.
You have written for everything from, as you mentioned, the late great City Pages to Rolling Stone. And I'm wondering how you decide, one thing is I'm wondering is how you decide whether or not to put Twin Cities content into some of the larger places that you've been published. But I'm also just wondering how you, not just Twin Cities, but how you choose the content. Do you, is your content different, or do you just write the same thing that you would always write if you're writing for a larger, more magazine that has a wider readership?
I think I understand the question. When I've written for Rolling Stone, and that's just a few times. That's been Record and Live reviews. The essays that I've written mostly have been born of my love for growing up in Minneapolis and documenting so much of the music scene and life. Some of my favorite things that I've ever written have been, you know, about Lake Harriet and Bede Makaska and the Rose Gardens and, the falls and just the nature and the state parks of Minnesota. I have a real propensity as a scribe to, you know, represent this area. And I think that's just natural and organic. I think all writers do that. They write about what's close to their heart and soil and soul. I think it occurs to me that, you know, I came up on punk rock and that was very formative in seeing how all of those punk rock scenes of those late 70s, early 80s, how different they were from each other, be it Athens, Georgia, or Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Chicago, or New York, or Los Angeles, how different they all were as movements about, you know, that, you know, REM didn't sound like Black Flag or, you know, the Wallets, say. And that struck me. That regionalism really struck me. And from there, I came to love writers who came from places, mm-hmm. you know, be it Flannery O'Connor or, you know, Studs Terkel or, John Irving and all of these writers who made you feel like not only they were connected to, you know, their home place, but brought you along with it. And I think that's the job on a very basic level. You're imparting information. And, you know, over the last pandemic year, I've learned so much about this state and the history of it. And I'm writing about it right now. And it's fascinating and disturbing and it makes you want to write. It makes you want to, as I go with this profession, I think I know more and more that you really have to, it has to burn in you. A story has to burn in you to want to write it. And I'm lucky because I have one of those right now that I'm writing and it burns. So it's, it's about Minnesota. So I want to learn about that. And there's no better way than writing to learn something and put it down and kind of know it then.
The burning.
So yeah, the collection is, you know, it's like 300 pages or something. And there's all sorts of interviews and wacky stories about my family and music and love and life.
I love your writing about place, especially you just, it's clear that you love Lake Harriet and the Rose Garden and the Peace Garden. You make it very, very real. I was wondering if you have one of those essays handy about Lake Harriet or the Rose Garden, especially. You wrote some really wonderful essays about the Rose Garden. Do you have anything you can find quickly?
Yes. Why, this one right here, Liz. How about Stop and Smell the Rose Gardens?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, this is from 2010. That was the year I think Obama visited, but that's not what this is about. Stop and smell the rose gardens. One summer, I found myself sitting on one of my favorite benches at the Rose Gardens by Lake Harriet. Full-on rapture mode was the order of the day as I savored the feast of natural beauty and sounds. Two young women enter the gates. One enthusiastically tried to show her unimpressed companion the breathtaking grace of the blooming buds. But the blank-faced, slack-jawed girl didn't get it, and they left the grounds as fast as they'd come in. I felt for the woman who was so clearly on a mission to testify to some soulmate or another about all that useless beauty, because a similar thing happens every day in the world. You can lead a loved one to a head-spinning kaleidoscope of roses, but you can't make them take a whiff. Which is good news, since that will keep the numbers down at what Lyndale resident Lisa Broke characterizes as the most beautiful spot in the city. That much was certainly true Tuesday evening as a glorious sunset into the placid lake, and Broke and her sons Max and Austin traipsed with a family friend amidst the luscious pine trees, screaming white and purple lilacs, and other fawning flora. "It's my favorite place in the whole city," says Broke, standing under the 10-year-old crab apple tree the family planted for her late husband, Alan Yutz. "I always come when the blossoms come out like this. It's like a treasure that happens once a year. I can't take in enough of the color. There are always people here, but you can have solitude, and I never feel like we can't find a place to call your own. In this, the best spring ever, the early orgy of sunshine has provided a chance to both get away and get in touch with yourself and nature, like few Minnesota seasons before it have. In the past 2 weeks, I have been accompanied to the Rose Gardens and her sister chill out space, the Peace Garden, by friends, musical instruments, a tape recorder, a radio for the ball game, books, notepads, and with my own rapt attention to bird watchers moving at the speed of sloth. Squirrels playing chicken, fellow sun worshipers resting and freeing their worried minds. A group of Japanese tourists lingering over the lilacs and cooing over the roses. Chirping teenager girls at a Somali wedding. A couple of hippie punk kids setting up hammocks in the pines. Languid semi-games of badminton, soccer, golf, catch. Kids dancing, running, flipping. Musicians playing quietly. Listeners thanking musicians. Strangers interacting. A gaggle of party girls who swear they saw gnomes tripping through the pines one day last week. A stranger who walked by did a double take between me and the sunset and said, "It doesn't get much better than this." Which is what I've been thinking. So far, the only comparison to the Rose Gardens, knee officially Lyndale Park, off King's Highway between 41st and 42nd Streets, the only place I can come up with is Northern California, which melds a similar burst of water, woods, and majestic colors. And author and journalist J. Wall Jasper, the late great J. Wall Jasper, who died this year, who visits the Rose Garden several times a week, discovered a kindred touchstone last year. I had the good fortune to have to go to Rome and write a story about public spaces, urban planning, and the soul of the city, said Wall Jasper, his family lolling on a food and drink strewn picnic blanket across the way. Of course, Rome is nothing like Minneapolis, but when I got home, I started thinking about what the Minneapolis version is of the Piazza, which is the great Roman institution where everyone hangs out. And I decided that clearly the Rose Gardens is Minneapolis's Piazza. On a beautiful spring day, it's where everyone wants to be. Not everybody, thankfully, not everybody. The Rose Gardens for me is an urban retreat from this fast life, said musician, writer, and student Pete Christensen, who tries to get to his favorite meditative spot at least once a day. It's a place where I can go to escape from the trappings of the mind and just be present with the beauty of the surroundings and the glimmer of the lake through the trees.
Thank you. That is beautiful. Just beautiful, as is the Rose Garden.
Yes.
I'm curious, speaking of late great, we just lost the City Pages so very recently. And We're getting less and less print media and more online. And I'm wondering, number one, how you feel about that, but also how you do you adjust your writing at all for online, or are you just letting yourself write as if you were writing for print online?
I love books and I love newspapers. And I will always write for both, both online and print. I mean, I don't see the difference other than, you know, aesthetically and tactilely. I like it all. I mean, I read everything online and I read magazine, newspapers, and books. But the worry is, with so many newspapers going under, it's, you know, literally the community of thought is hurt that way. Mm-hmm. You know, it's diminished. And I said this when City Pages went down, and I said it when the Southwest Journal went down, and I'm just haunted, and I remain haunted by where all those stories went, you know, that we were reading every week and every other week. Lots of stories by lots of working journalists. And where are those now? And, you know, Sahan Journal picks up the slack, and others for sure. Community newspapers and online, MinnPost is great. But there's something to an identity that a paper develops over years, you know, which City Pages did for 40 years. And, you know, the Southwest Journal, which started out as Skyway News, mm-hmm. they're very local, you know, very much a part of the community. And they had very distinct identities. So where does that go? That's just kind of a haunting thing for me. And I think we kind of lived through a glory days of newspapers in this town without even really knowing it. We knew that, you know, when the Reader went down and et cetera, you know, it signaled a change then, but you know, this is it. The pandemic has really laid bare everything. And, you know, we're down to basics. You know, I wouldn't feel comfortable writing a lot of the stuff that I wrote, say, for the Southwest Journal all those years, so personally and so kind of, because the world is so different than it's changed so much in the last, you know, 4 years, 5-6 years, and now this year. So interesting to think about it all.
We're starting to run out of time here, which I can't believe, because we just started. I guess the last thing I'll
do it again, Liz, please.
Yeah, really. You seem to be in touch with Eastern philosophy to some extent in some of your writing, and I'm wondering if you would share some of your thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I just read a great quote from my dad. My dad said, he goes back to the quote, 100 monks, 100 different versions of God. And that comes from the East, you know, for sure. Specifically Japan, which is, you know, which is not mono-religious at all. And it incorporates all sorts of religion. But yeah, I've done a lot of study about, you know, Buddhism and when it hit here in the 1860s and in America. And I have ascribed to a lot of that presence, and both Ram Dass, Be Here Now, and be it Joseph Campbell. I mean, we could go through all the kind of modern day saints. Follow Your Bliss, you know, and you know, or you know, or J. Krishnamurti, to quote another one of my father's favorites. Those were all those they were all from the East, and they believe that we are God, and we are the creators of our lives. And there's a lot to that. And I do enjoy writing about that and chewing on it. Then stepping away from it and, you know, go run around the lake or something and scream into the void.
Well, geez, it is time to wrap it up here. I'll just say, what's next in your writing?
What's next? Well, I spent the last few days writing my father's eulogy, and I'm going to deliver that tomorrow morning.
Yes.
And after that, I'm going to get back to working on, I have a big writing project I'm working on that I'm kind of keeping to myself. And I'm continuing to freelance too. So, and I'm working on a new record as a songwriter.
All right.
And just going to keep plugging along, being a dad and trying to get the family dog to behave and so we can go back to the dog park in the spring. Because it's not happening it right now, Liz.
Oh, he's
it's not happening.
Oh, no. Well, you know what they say, just keep your behind in the chair and keep writing. We've been talking with
That's Jim, exactly right.
We've been talking with Jim Walsh, author of Fear and Loving in South Minneapolis and many other things. I loved mixtapes. We interviewed you for that, didn't we? The mixtapes and...
I don't think so. I don't think I've been on Right on Radio for a couple of decades, it feels
wow.
like.
Well,
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, it's good to have you here. So we're going to let you go. And once again, very, very sorry to know about your dad. And we will send you some good KFAI energy to help you with the healing process. So thank you very
much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And we will see you again soon, I hope. Take care.
Thank you, Liz and KFAI. I love you guys.